So welcome to today's lecture. So I have your homework assignments, so please remind me to give them back to you at the end of the lecture, otherwise I'll forget. So I want to recap a little bit what we talked about and also anticipate what we're going to be talking about in the next few minutes. I'll do this with this diagram, which I see now is very poorly drawn, but I think you'll get the picture from that. And we're talking about the Kerr spacetime, so I won't write down the metric again, but I'll recap some of the notation that we have used and will be using in this lecture. So rho squared, delta, and sigma are just functions of r and theta. We have the mass parameter of the spacetime in m, and we have the angular momentum parameter. It's actually angular momentum divided by mass. That's the a parameter. I've defined an omega, which had a role to play in describing the angular velocity of observers with zero angular momentum. And that's, you know, related to metric components, and it works out to be this. So that's something we've talked about. And we've talked about the fact that the spacetime has two killing vectors, one which is, you know, at least at infinity is time-like, and the other one is space-like, describing a rotation around the z-axis. So we have, you know, started to learn about the spacetime by introducing several classes of observers. So we've talked about observers with zero angular momentum. We've talked about static observers. And today I'm going to continue with that line of discussion by talking about stationary observers. But let's recap a little bit and anticipate a little bit what we're going to be talking about. So we've talked about a static limit, which has to do with the fact that if we're trying to place observers that are going to be static in the spacetime, namely moving purely in the time direction, then we saw that, well, in order for those observers to exist, it was, of course, crucial that gamma be less than infinity, but in fact, there is a place in the spacetime where that condition is no longer satisfied. And so the static limit corresponded to the fact that gamma, you know, for this specific location in space-time turns out to be infinity. That means that the vector T alpha, which we think of it as a time-like vector, is in fact turning into a null vector at this position. So the fact that we can no longer normalize U as a vector means that the T vector becomes null. And that's something that happened when r was equal to what I call the static limit, a function of theta given by m minus square root of m squared minus a squared cosine squared theta. And the interpretation of this is that if we're outside of the static limit for r larger than that, then we can have static observers in the space-time, but if we try to place them too close to the center, then we no longer can maintain the static observer, and that's basically, you know, it's basically the conclusion that the black hole rotation is overwhelming the ability to stay static, and the, you know, the black hole is forcing the observer to rotate along with it. So that's the static limit. And, you know, in the case of Schwarzschild, the time-like killing vector going null was the signal that we had, you know, reached the event horizon. So a natural question to ask is now, you know, is it true also for the Kerr black hole? And the way to test this is to say, well, here's a surface, here's a hypersurface defined in the four-dimensional space-time. We can calculate the normal to that surface, and we can calculate whether that normal is a null normal or something else. If it's null, then that means that the surface itself is going to be a null surface, and that would be, you know, a pretty good candidate for an event horizon. But it turns out that in this case, that surface is not null. The normal vector is actually space-like, and that means that the surface itself is a time-like surface. So this defines a time-like surface. And because it's a time-like surface, of course, it's not a candidate for an event horizon. So we're going to find an event horizon that's going to be that structure that I've described here, but it's not that. They happen to coincide at those two points, but for any other values of the angle, so that the, you know, this is a polar diagram where theta is the angle relative to the polar axis there. So except for theta equals zero and theta equals pi, those two surfaces are distinct. And in the static limit, we're not talking about an event horizon. So this is not the event horizon of the black hole. To find the event horizon of the black hole, where that's going to be the discussion that we're going to have next, the event horizon, I'm going to anticipate this, I'll define it in terms of those classes of observers that we'll talk about, but I'll just say that this is a very distinct place, except for those two values for the angle, where m happens to be equal to, sorry, I think I had the wrong sign here. Yeah, this was supposed to be a plus m squared minus a squared. And that's what I'm describing here. So this r equals r plus figure here is where the event horizon is. And this is a place where, you know, there's going to be some vector becoming null, but it's not going to be just t alpha. It's going to be a combination of t alpha and phi alpha. So that's what we'll talk about. And one way of justifying that this is indeed the event horizon is to say that, well, this is another hypersurface in space-time, and that hypersurface turns out to have a null normal, and that makes it a null surface. So this is a null surface, as it must be for an event horizon, and because it's a fixed place in the radial coordinate, well, you know, it's also a stationary null surface, as we're going to confirm when we look at the kinematics of the null generators on the event horizon. So, you know, we're going to come to that in the course of this lecture. Okay, so let's talk about a different class of observers. I'm going to call them stationary observers. And the strategy here is that I'm going to try to go, you know, beyond the static limit by allowing the observer to rotate around the black hole. So we know that the black hole is really trying very hard to force rotation on our observer, so we're going to let that happen. And we're going to try to go beyond the static limit by, you know, succumbing to that that black hole rotation. So the class of observers that I'll look into here is going to be where there's going to be a component of the four velocity in the direction of time, of course, but then there's going to be also a phi component with some constant angular velocity omega. So omega is a constant angular velocity, and the velocity vector has a component in time, a component in phi, and the ratio is going to give, of course, the ratio is going to be omega, and omega is going to be for that observer d phi dt, so that's why we call it an angular velocity. The idea here is that by allowing the observer to rotate in some direction, maybe we have a way of, you know, going inside the static limit and try to go deeper into the space-time while maintaining the fact that this is a time-like observer with a normalized velocity vector. We call them stationary observers because the observer rotates around the black hole, so, but the r position doesn't change, and the theta position doesn't change. And that means that the observer going around the black hole doesn't perceive any change in the gravitational field. If there were oscillations in r or oscillations in theta, the observer would perceive a change in gravitational field because, you know, the kerr-metric depends on r and depends on theta, but because it doesn't depend on t, doesn't depend on phi, moving in t and phi only means that, well, there's no, you know, there's no change in gravitational field according to this observer. So that, you know, that's the reason for the name. Okay. So What I want to do here is to play the same trick we did before. So we can have those observers so long as gamma, the normalization factor, is finite. And as soon as it turns to infinity, we have the failure of the vector here to stay time-like, and that will have to do with the fact that this vector over here is turning null. So that's, you know, that's the game we're going to play now. It is going to be very similar to what we did previously for the static observers. So what I want to do is to figure out what gamma is, and we're going to use the normalization condition for the velocity vector. And we just do the calculation. That's going to be gamma squared g alpha beta t alpha plus omega phi alpha t beta plus omega phi beta. So we just do the calculation and make everything explicit. So gamma squared will be a common factor. And then when I start multiplying, I'm going to have gtt. I'm going to have 2 gt phi coming from the cross terms here, multiplying omega. And then I'm going to have those two terms here involving omega squared, and that will come with a g phi phi. All right, so far so good. I'm going to factorize a g phi phi, which is positive. And I'm going to factorize a minus sign because the left-hand side is negative. So let's do that. I'm going to factorize a minus sign. And I'm going to factorize a g phi phi. And then I'm going to go from over here in the brackets. So the first term is now going to be minus omega squared. Then we're going to have minus 2 gt phi over g phi phi, multiplying omega. And that ratio of metric functions is what we called little omega before. So I'm going to reintroduce that notation. And then finally, we have minus gtt and divided by g phi phi. So let's just rewrite this one more time. We have that common factor. Then we have minus omega squared. We have minus 2 little omega, sorry, plus 2 little omega times big omega, because little omega is minus that. And you can see that with the minus sign, we get something which is positive. And then finally, we get minus gtt. Gtt is, at least far enough away from the black hole. That's going to be minus gtt is going to be positive, divided by g phi phi. Okay, so to solve for gamma, I just need to, to put everything else onto the other side, and I'm going to get that gamma is going to be related to 1 over that bracket over here. And what we want to ensure is that gamma is smaller than infinity, and that will be true whenever the quantity we have in the bracket there turns out to be greater than 0. So we're going to have gamma is less than infinity when the bracket is going to be greater than 0. And there will be a place in the space-time where that condition, is no longer satisfied. And that's going to be our stationary limit, where it's going to be impossible to support those stationary observers. And then where I'm going to go with this is that, I'm going to make a case that that stationary limit, where this condition is no longer fulfilled, that's that R plus quantity that we've talked about, and that corresponds to the event horizon of the black hole. So we want to basically, so the stationary limit is where this condition is no longer fulfilled. So that corresponds to that quantity on the left being 0. And that is, so let me put it differently. Let me put it differently. Let me write this out as, so I'm going to have to solve a quadratic equation, obviously, if I want to put that equal to zero. And to anticipate this, I'm going to factorize it. And I'm going to say that this is going to be omega plus minus omega times omega minus, where omega plus and omega minus are going to be the two solutions to that quadratic equation. I write it like this because I have an overall minus sign in front of omega squared. And the condition then is that this product be greater than zero. And what we find from all of this is that we can have stationary observers provided that omega is larger than a certain lower limit, omega minus, and smaller than an upper limit, omega plus. So we can maintain those stationary observers in the space-time, provided that the angular velocity that we give those observers is bounded between the lower limit, omega minus, and omega plus. And there will be a point where we no longer can fulfill that condition, as I said before, when the right-hand side goes to zero, or when the inequality here is replaced by inequality, then that's going to be a condition that either omega is equal to omega plus or omega minus. And that's where we'll see the limit of our stationary observers, and that's going to be the R plus, place that I already identified on the board. I hope the idea is clear. So long as this condition is satisfied, we can have stationary observers. And when it's no longer satisfied, and the boundary of that is going to be when it's equal to zero, that's where gamma is going to turn infinity. And that's where that vector over here will turn to be null. But so long as the condition is fulfilled, then we have this bound on the angular velocity between the lower bound and the upper bound here. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, to identify what this means, we have to actually solve the quadratic equation to find the roots of the quadratic equation here. And that's, a pretty simple calculation. I won't bore you with the details. I'll just tell you that the two roots are given by little omega plus or minus delta to the 1/2 rho squared divided by sigma divided by sine theta. So when you solve the quadratic equation for the two roots, you find those. And then the idea is that our stationary observers can live in that space-time provided that omega, the angular velocity, is between those two roots. So in order to work out what this means, we can do a plot where I'm going to plot either one of those two roots. In fact, I'm going to plot both as a function of r. It's actually a function of r and theta, so I'm going to pick some value of theta. Could be pi over 2 if I want to work on the equatorial plane. It can be anything, doesn't matter. Qualitatively, the plots will look very similar. There's going to be two interesting values of r, one corresponding to r plus, one corresponding to, let me put it here, one corresponding to r static. And if I'm to plot those functions here, so let me plot the upper one first, omega plus. Well, the structure of omega plus looks something like this. It starts over here, then it grows for a bit, and then it decays for a bit, and eventually it's going to go all the way to zero. So it's looked at like this. So that's omega plus as a function of r for some value of theta. This place over here is where, is where I get a double root. So when I plot omega minus, I find that it also starts here because it becomes a double root when all of this here vanishes. And it starts like this, and then it changes sign over here, and then it eventually goes back towards zero when r goes large. So two interesting places, this one over here where we have a double root, and this place over here where the root is actually zero. So that's omega minus, And the idea is that I can have stationary observers so long as my angular velocity is bounded between those two curves. So we have the possibility of establishing a stationary observer if we choose omega to be between those two curves. So that can be over here, it can be over here. And if we're in this region over here, well, the lower root is actually negative, the upper root is positive. But at this point, the lower root goes to zero. And that's just to say that beyond this point, the omega, the angular velocity, has to be larger than zero. At this point, the zero value, well, that's the stationary observer. That's a static observer. So a stationary observer with omega equal to zero, namely if we're right here, then that's a static observer. And we know that the static observer lives only outside of the static limit. So that's a situation where our static observer would have a value, zero, that's between the two curves. But that value of zero, of course, ceases to be a valid, value for omega as soon as we go beyond the static limit. And that's again, the statement that beyond the static limit, we cannot have an omega of zero, namely we cannot have a static observer. To be inside that region, at least for a while, we can have a stationary observer provided that the angular velocity is positive and bounded between omega minus and omega plus. And you see what happens there. As you get closer and closer, that range becomes narrower and narrower. And as you reach this limit, we find that the two roots coalesce into a single one. And beyond that, well, it's impossible. So the stationary observers can exist outside of R plus, provided that the omega is adjusted correspondingly. And the range of values, of possible values, increases as you go away from the black hole, and then it narrows as you go back toward the black hole. And eventually it's narrowed down to one and only one possible value. And after that, it's no longer possible to sustain those stationary observers. So clearly there's something very significant going on here. And as I anticipated before, well, my claim is that this is the event horizon. So when delta is equal to zero, that's the only possibility for having anything going to zero with the second term, we have a double root. And a double root for omega plus, so omega minus is equal to omega plus. And the common value of the root is going to be little omega evaluated at that place where delta goes to zero. So what's delta? Well, delta is quadratic in R. So when we solve for delta is equal to zero, well, we get two roots, but the one that's relevant here is the largest one. And the largest one is what I described before. And that is the place where we have, well, a stationary limit, and that turns out to be the event horizon because that surface turns out to be null. So we'll get to that in just a minute. So that's the place where delta is equal to zero, and the double root for omega, I'll call it omega h. Well, that turns out to be omega, little omega, evaluated at r equals r plus. And then all we have to do is to go back to our expression for omega, little omega, and that's equal to 2ma r plus divided by sigma. But sigma evaluated at r plus is just this, because that's zero. So it's going to be R plus squared plus A squared, all squared. I could leave it at that, but I can simplify it. This is 2m R plus times A divided by R plus squared plus A squared is 2mr plus squared. So I can simplify this to be a over 2mr plus. I can leave it at that, but sometimes it's written as a over r plus squared plus a squared. So that's the statement that if we let our stationary observers get all the way in to where they can no longer possibly exist, at that point, they have to rotate with a very specific and unique value for the angular velocity. The range of possible values has reduced all the way down to one and only one specific value that happens to be equal to that one. And, you know, as we keep developing this, we're going to see that, well, that's the angular velocity of the black hole itself, because the null generators of the black hole horizon themselves have that value for the angular velocity. So the generators rotate with omega h, and observers that are getting very, very close to the black hole are basically forced to co-rotate with the black hole with the same angular velocity. So that's, you know, that's something we get from all of this. So let me copy this because we'll probably need it later. So this is a over r plus squared plus a squared, and that's the black hole angular velocity, or the angular velocity of the horizon in a very, you know, specific sense that I'll describe in a moment. So that's something that we learned from this. And then the other thing that we can verify is that, well, this surface where this all happens is actually a null surface. So the surface r equals r plus is actually a null surface, and that makes it a good candidate for the event horizon, and for all the other reasons that we'll spell out as we go into that a bit more, we're going to see that it is the event horizon. So it is the event horizon of the Kerr black hole. Right. So I'll come back to you in a moment. Let me just say a couple of more things. So we reached the limit of the stationary. So we reached the stationary limit when we can no longer normalize u, the time-like vector, because gamma is going to infinity. And that means that this vector over here, or that one over here, that's the vector that's going null. But the thing is that the omega, where this happens, you know, by the time we reach the stationary limit, that omega is now, is now down to one and only one possible value. So the vector that's going null is actually t alpha plus omega h phi alpha. So another thing that we can write down here is that the vector t alpha plus omega h phi alpha is null at r equals r plus. And that's something that you can verify. So we have a null vector that will be describing the, that will be the tangent vector to the null generators of the event horizon. And we have a null surface, and everything fits together and, you know, is compatible with all of the stuff that we've talked about when we were talking about null hypersurfaces. So the event horizon of a Kerr black hole is that surface r equals r plus. And on that surface, we have that this vector over here, that linear combination t alpha plus phi alpha with an omega h in front, is the null vector that is at once normal to the event horizon and tangent to the null generators. So you had a question?
Yeah, if we added onto that omega r graph, if we added Kepler's law, I assume sort of sit in the interior region mostly.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so the observers here were not required to be geodesic observers. But if we make them geodesic observers, then that will force omega to have a very specific value. And sure enough, it's going to be somewhere in the middle of the two bounds. Is that answering your question?
Okay, so we weren't requiring them to be geodesic.
No. So this four velocity here was never required to satisfy the geodesic equation. If we make it satisfy the geodesic equation, then we're going to find that omega has to be given by a very specific function of r and theta. And that specific function of r and theta would define another curve, and that curve would be, you know, something like that.
And I assume Kepler's law would be, you know.
Well, that's Kepler's law. That curve is Kepler's law. It would be the Kerr equivalent to Kepler's law, right?
Right. So I mean, like the Newtonian Kepler's law, I assume, deviates from that.
Oh, well, at infinity, it would recover, right?
Right.
When all the rotational effects and relativistic effects are unimportant, then you would recover the usual statement of Kepler's law. But that would be the Kerr generalization of that. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Good question. Thank you.
And actually, for small a, we get completely Newtonian picture, right? We have omega h, which is angular momentum over the radius squared.
Right. So yeah. So that has an interpretation in terms of a moment of inertia, and yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So relationship between angular velocity and angular momentum. Well, that's the moment of inertia. So you can use this to define the moment of inertia of a black hole, even though the black hole itself is completely relativistic and there's no Newtonian limit to an event horizon. Right? Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, yeah. You can certainly assign a lot of Newtonian interpretation to a lot of this. Now, maybe you were wondering. Okay, so here I chose the largest route to be the place where this was happening. And the reason why I chose the largest route is because, well, clearly that's going to be the first place where this happens. And then it's sort of game over because that's already the limit of the black hole. But, you know, nevertheless, there is an inner, there's a lower route, r minus, where you would have a minus sign here. So we have two routes to that equation. The outer route corresponds to the event horizon of the black hole, but there must be something that corresponds to the inner r minus route. And sure enough, you know, I can complete this diagram with another sphere like this. That would be the r equals r minus sphere. And you know, that would have some significance in the Kerr space-time, but it would be confined to be within the black hole. And here you can either choose to, you know, pursue this question or choose to ignore this question, because who cares, it's inside, you know, we'll never get there, we'll never see, we'll never report back on what we might find if we went inside. But, you know, I'll just point out that if you choose to actually explore the insides of a Kerr black hole, it gets very exotic, very strange, very, you know, very peculiar. And there are all sorts of things that could be said about this, but I won't say them in this class. Okay, so I think with that we have, you know, some understanding of what the Kerr spacetime is all about, and the dominant, you know, theme is really that rotation is basically taking over everything. You fall in with zero angular momentum, you acquire rotation, you try to maintain yourself static in the spacetime, and the rotation of the black hole forces you to go outside of that static state if you're too close, and then even if you allow yourself to rotate around the black hole, then if you go close enough to the black hole, you're going to be forced to rotate with one and only one very specific value of the angular momentum, angular velocity, and that's the black hole's own rotation. So rotation is really, you know, the big feature of the Kerr spacetime, something that Schwarzschild, you know, didn't have anything to say about. Other than that, well, we're talking about a spacetime that has two killing vectors, one of which goes null on the stationary horizon, on the static limit, sorry, and this interesting linear combination here that actually goes null at the stationary limit, that is the event horizon. And from now on, well, I think now we can really investigate the nature of the event horizon and describe it with all the techniques that we have at our disposal. It's a station, you know, it's a null surface with null generators, so we can look into all of this and apply all of our tricks to really, you know, give a very good idea of what's going on there. Yep.
So just a thought experiment to make sure I understand what's going on. So imagine I'm on the geodesic curve,
mm-hmm.
at some R, and I'm just calling it geodesic, and then now I start firing a thruster, but I have to fire the thruster in a specific way such that I stay in a circular orbit.
Right.
But I just increase velocity.
Right.
So I move up on that curve, and then I can increase my thruster as much as I want, but eventually I limit towards omega plus.
Right.
And I assume that I can just keep increasing my thruster as much as I want, but I just approach this limit.
Right. So you would be basically trying to catch up with the speed of light.
Right.
You know, but yourself being limited to be a time-like observer.
And then if I'm inside the our static region, I now point my thruster in the opposite direction, and I try to slow down, but I reach a limit that's positive. A point where I can't get any less angular velocity.
That's right.
But then outside of our static region, I can in fact change direction.
Yeah, you can go from there would be, Kepler's law would be insensitive to sine, right? So there would be two versions of Kepler's law, presumably, that would look somewhat like this. So one where you have a positive angular velocity, the other one negative. And then they would all meet here. But yeah, I mean, if you were, I forget what you were saying before.
Yeah, so I guess I start with positive Kepler's law.
Right.
And then I turn my thruster, I try to slow down while staying on a circular path.
Right.
And I can, in fact, change direction when I'm
out. Oh, yeah, no, that's right. So you can boost yourself to anti-corroding.
Exactly. I can now orbit retrograde.
Right. Okay. Yep. So yeah, so I think that diagram is telling you all of this stuff.
Is there a meaning behind the fact that R plus doesn't depend on the angle? So it's just.
Yeah, I mean, there's something deep about this, although, you know, perhaps it's not that deep because here we happen to choose one specific coordinate system. And in that coordinate system, R plus happens to be independent of theta. But there's going to be ramifications of this, and we're going to see that there's something deep buried in those statements that we're going to be identifying along the way.
Is that this extra symmetry or this extra this Carter or some Carter?
No, I don't think so. I think it's really just a happy coincidence or a happy consequence of the coordinates. We're going to see that the intrinsic geometry of the event horizon is certainly not spherical. So we could have come up with a different coordinate system where the horizon position would have been theta dependent in that other coordinate system. It just happens that, you know, for the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, there's a lot of simplicity that gets revealed, but it's not geometrical in nature. It's basically coordinate statements. But, you know, that's true for the description of R plus, but there's going to be something deeper that will, you know, when we talk about the zeroth law of black hole mechanics, we're going to see that, you know, there's something invariant according to position on the horizon, and that's very deep, that's very geometrical. So we'll get there. All right. Other questions about this? Okay. So let's really focus on the event horizon. That's where I want to take us now. And while we know where it is, right, it's where R plus, R is equal to R plus. And we have, you know, a description of the null vector that describes, the null generators. That's tangent to the null generators. So already we know quite a lot. But we would like to identify some, you know, metric aspects of the event horizon. And the problem we're facing here, like we did for Schwarzschild, is that the Kerr metric expressed in the usual TR theta phi coordinates is badly singular on the event horizon. So we have to come up with a fix for that. And it's the same story, right? An observer falling in toward the black hole would do so with infinite coordinate t time, like it did for Schwarzschild. And we have to come up with a fix. We have to come up with a new time coordinate where this doesn't happen because, you know, the free fall time in terms of proper time is perfectly finite. So we know that there's nothing, strange really going on metrically on the event horizon. We know that the time coordinate is just going to be a bad coordinate. It's a bit worse than this for Kerr because remember that all those observers that are trying to approach the horizon are forced to rotate with a fixed angular velocity. So angular velocity is d phi dt, and d phi dt is going to be approaching omega h for basically all observers that are trying to approach the event horizon. If t is going to infinity and d phi dt is, you know, a finite number, it's going to be true that phi also will be approaching infinity as we follow the motion of those observers. So as the observers try to fall in, they take an infinite coordinate time to do that. And because of that, you know, finite, you know, limits, you know, angular velocity speed, they will also undergo an infinite number of oscillations in phi before they get through the singularity, get through the event horizon. So it's not just t that's a bad coordinate in Kerr, it's also phi. So we have to fix both. And we have to fix both because of that, you know, that sort of universal limit to the angular velocity of an observer. It's a bit of a, you know, it's not exactly, I mean, it's not a, you know, you could attack me on this argument, but I think it's suggestive of the fact that, that, you know, there are two coordinates that will be problematic in the Kerr space-time, and we have to fix those. So various ways, there are lots of ways that we can fix that. So let's see. So let's call that regular coordinates. Regular coordinates for Kerr. So it's essentially the same problem as we faced for Schwarzschild, but now compounded with the fact that it's not just t, it's also phi. And we're, you know, there are lots of ways where we can find alternative coordinate systems for Kerr. There's a method where we can sort of reproduce the Kruskal coordinates that we had for Schwarzschild and adapt them for Kerr. So we could go that way, but I won't. The fix that we did for Schwarzschild relied on the behavior of incoming light rays. And that's something we can adapt very easily for Kerr. So we're going to apply the same strategy for Kerr. We're going to, you know, model our coordinates or anchor the coordinates to the behavior of incoming light rays. And we're going to come up with, you know, a good system of coordinates for Kerr. And that's how we're going to be able to probe the, you know, vicinity of the event horizon. Yep.
Sorry, just before you get too far into this next section. Omega plus and minus, they're Newtonian limits?
No. That's calculated in full, full GR.
What are the Newtonian limits? Like, I assume in Newtonian mechanics, my intuition is that they should just be plus or minus infinity.
No, so the asymptotic behavior is, if I remember correctly, 1 over r. It's either sine or cosine theta, I don't remember. Let's say sine theta. Plus or minus. So it falls off as 1 over r.
Okay. Because I don't remember like discussing these like omega plus minus in Newtonian dynamics, like we usually just think about geodesic orbits, whatever. But
right. So yeah, so those curves here would go as 1 over r for the 3 halves, right? So they fall off faster.
But there's also a Newtonian limit for how much you can force yourself into a circular orbit, I guess.
Well, all of that is tied to vectors going null, so I think we're outside the Newtonian regime here. So it's
you should be able to go as fast as you like in Newtonian physics.
Well, so the angular velocity will always be, I mean, if you want to, so if the linear velocity is bounded by the speed of light, the angular velocity has to be bounded by the speed of light divided by r, right?
Right.
Or, you know, or something that, so it's the lever arm that we're dealing with here. So it really reflects that bound by the speed of light. So yeah, it's not really a Newtonian consideration. Okay, so we're good? Okay. All right, so as I said before, we're gonna try to find regular coordinates by basically looking at the behavior of incoming light rays. And I'm not gonna, you know, spend much time doing this. I'll just give you what the answer is. But, you know, there could be a lot, you know, to this question because there are lots of different light rays that we could look into. So the behavior of light rays in the Kerr spacetime, outgoing or incoming, is a lot more complicated than for Schwarzschild. In Schwarzschild, we have this natural family of light rays that were, you know, forming the light cones for us. They didn't move in the angular directions. But here, you know, because of this rotational business, I mean, it's impossible to find light rays that are spherical in the same sense. So there's a lot of, you know, work that needs to be done into finding a family of light rays that are, you know, nice and well-behaved and all of this. And I'll skip all of this discussion. I'll just say that, well, there's a family of null geodesics that's called the principal null congruence of the Kerr spacetime. In fact, there's two. You know, there's two of those, one for outgoing light rays and the other family for incoming light rays. And what we're doing here is to adopt this family of light rays to define coordinates for us. So this is based on the principal null congruence of the Kerr spacetime. And if you're curious about this, you can read the relevant sections in the book or any other book that would describe that for you. But all I'm saying is that by tying the coordinates to those light rays and choosing coordinates that are constant on those light rays, then we can basically fix the coordinate problems of the Kerr metric. And the way to do this is to define a V that's analogous to what we had before in Schwarzschild. That's going to be T plus a certain integral. And that integral is a generalization to what we had for Schwarzschild. What we had for Schwarzschild was 1 over f, f being 1 minus 2m over r. And if you take your delta and put a equal to 0, and take this and put a equal to 0, that's exactly what we had for Schwarzschild. So it's basically a generalization to what we had for Schwarzschild that defines a coordinate, v that's constant on incoming light rays. And that's not enough because, as I said, we have to fix the phi coordinate as well. So I'm going to define a new angular coordinate. I'm going to call it phi. And it's going to be related to the old phi by another integral like this. And in that case, of course, we had no Schwarzschild analog because that integral goes away if a goes to 0. And that's also constant on incoming light rays. So the strategy is use the light rays or this, you know, particular family of light rays and attach coordinates on them. And because the light rays go through the event horizon without encountering any singularity or anything peculiar, then that pretty much guarantees that the Kerr metric re-expressed in terms of those coordinates will have, you know, perfectly well-behaved behavior as we go from outside to inside the event horizon. So the idea is to just make this replacement. So everywhere in the Kerr metric, we're going to say that dt is going to be dv minus r squared or plus a squared divided by delta dr. And we're going to make this replacement in the Kerr metric. And we're going to say that d phi is going to be d psi minus a over delta dr. And we're going to make this replacement in the Kerr metric, and then we're gonna write the metric of the Kerr spacetime in V R theta psi coordinates. And you can find all the expressions in my notes or in the book. I won't write it out here, but you know, it's a bit more complicated. There are more off-diagonal terms now. It's a bit more complicated than before, but it's, you know, regular across the event horizon. So in those new coordinates, we have all the same features that we had before. For example, we still have the two killing vectors. And that's obvious because, you know, the Kerr metric previously didn't depend on t. So if it didn't depend on T, it's not going to depend on V after making the replacement. And it didn't depend on phi, and if it didn't depend on phi, it's not going to depend on psi after we make the change of coordinates. So we still have the same, you know, the same two killing vectors, but now they're expressed in terms of the new coordinates. So in V, R, theta, psi coordinates, what we have is a, well, mostly time-like killing vector that has just an entry along V, and that's it. That reflects the V invariance of the metric. And we have a phi killing vector, which now has a component only along the psi direction, and that reflects the psi independence of the metric. And if you don't believe me about those coordinate assignments for the same killing vectors, you can go through the coordinate transformation and you will verify that, well, these are the VR theta psi components of the killing vector. And the notion that this linear combination of killing vectors goes null on the event horizon, well, that was not a coordinate dependent statement. It was just a statement about the vector. Well, that means that in this new coordinate system, we're going to have exactly the same statement. So what I'm going to say is that I'm going to give it a name K, which is the linear combination of the T and phi killing vectors that is null on the event horizon, which is still located at R equals R plus, which is still given by M plus M squared minus A squared. The difference that the new coordinates make is the fact that now we can actually calculate all sorts of things associated with the null vector. We can verify that it's null. That's one thing. We can calculate whether or not it satisfies the geodesic equation. And of course, it must, because it's, you know, a normal, it's normal to the null hypersurface. And we can calculate all sorts of things like the expansion, like the shear, like everything else. We can do all of those computations. And to do those computations, we need a regular coordinate system where we work. And if we work on the event horizon, we certainly need to have good coordinates on the event horizon. So all of that stuff that we've talked about before now is accessible for direct, you know, exploration, because we have the right coordinate system to actually do everything we might, you know, we might be curious about doing. So what I'm going to do next, and let's see, let me look at the time. Oh yeah, still lots of time. What I'm going to do next is to reformulate, you know, well, continue to explore the structure of the event horizon in Kerr, but now I'm going to formulate this in a language that we're used to when we were talking about congruences of null geodesics and null hypersurfaces. So we have all of this machinery that we spent a lot of time working through for a purpose. Now the purpose, you know, is really coming through. I want to apply all of this machinery to a description of the Kerr horizon. So that's going to be what we're going to be doing next. And then I think at some point in the afternoon, I'm going to generalize this from Kerr black holes to other kinds of black holes that we might have if the black hole is not perfectly isolated in a vacuum, you know, in a vacuum world. What if there was a mass distribution outside the black hole? We would still have a black hole. It would not be described by the Kerr metric because of the influence of the matter outside. What I'm going to be saying is that a lot of what we're talking about here in the context of Kerr specifically will actually survive in much more general settings as we expand the discussion. So what we're doing here is not just, you know, valid for Kerr. We're going to find that it actually survives, sometimes with, you know, modifications to a situation where the black hole is there, but it's not a Kerr black hole because it's not sitting in a vacuum environment. Okay, so any questions about this before we get moving? Okay, let's get going then. All right, so I want to look at the description of the event horizon of a Kerr black hole, and I'm going to do it in the way we know how, because we're dealing with a null surface that is being traced by null geodesics. So all of the stuff that we talked about is really here to come and help us describe these things in a very geometrical and nice way. Okay, so let's see. So I'm going to try to draw something. I'm going to draw the event horizon as a cylinder. Normally, I would draw a null surface as a null cone, something like this, but the null cone really gives us an impression that the light rays are expanding out as they go from small distance to large distance. Here we have light rays that stay put, right? They stay at the event horizon, so it's a stationary null surface. So I'm going to draw it like this. If I were to draw this for Schwarzschild spacetime, my null generators would be all going straight. But here I want to convey a sense that, well, my null generators are actually moving with angular velocity, so they have to wrap around the cylinder because they do wrap around the event horizon with, you know, the omega h angular velocity. So I'm going to draw it, I'm going to try to draw them like this. So imagine those, in the old days we would call that a barber pole, but I don't think we have barber shops anymore, so that wouldn't be very informative. So that's a rather poor drawing, but you can imagine we have a null generator that wraps around the cylinder. And that sort of conveys the sense that we have a positive angular velocity around the event horizon. So that would be one of the generators, that would be a second generator. And we would have a whole collection of generators going around like this. Maybe I'll draw one more. All right, so that's my null surface. So this is the event horizon, which is a null hypersurface in the curve spacetime. We have the null generators. So let me say that this is the null generators of the event horizon. And they have a tangent vector attached to them. And the tangent vector is precisely that linear combination of Killing vectors that we've talked about. And in components, VR theta phi component, we have an entry along V, an entry along phi, and nothing else. And that's a null vector. And that's a vector that's tangent to the null generators. And the going around the cylinder here is really conveying the sense that that the generators are moving with positive angular velocity given by omega h. All right, so that's one way of describing all of this. We're going to work out the geodesic equation for that vector. But then I really want to put all of this in the language of null hypersurfaces the way that we've described them before. And when we were describing them before, we had, here's a patch of that null surface. And we had the generators that we were using to put down a coordinate system on the null surface. And I want to keep doing that here. So we had the null generators over here. They came with their tangent vector, k alpha. we had a parameter lambda that was going along the GD6. But now I'm going to call it V because, you know, dV d lambda is 1, therefore lambda is equal to V. So the parameter that goes along the GD6 that I used to call lambda, I now call V. And the coordinate system was such that we had generator labels that were constant on each generator. And we were using the generators as a way of defining a convenient coordinate system on the horizon. And that allowed us to calculate all sorts of things. And you know, we developed a big formalism to do these things. So I just want to basically relate the two descriptions. In other words, what I want to do here is to come up with an intrinsic coordinate system on the horizon that will be, you know, along the lines that that we defined when we were talking about generic null hypersurfaces. They didn't have to be horizons, but now it would be specifically a horizon. So we're not too far off because we know that our generators are moving with constant value of r. R is everywhere equal to r plus. They are moving with constant value of theta. So theta could be used as a generator label. But psi, the new angle, while is not, it's not a co-moving coordinate. It's not constant on the generator because of that effect over here. Psi is increasing monotonically with V as we follow the motion of the generators. So we're going to have to adapt this a little bit and overcome that little obstacle, but it's really not a big deal. All right, so we'll get there soon enough. But before I get there, I just want to work out something. So this is a vector that's defined to be the null normal to that null hypersurface. And it's guaranteed that this vector will satisfy the GD6 equation. So something that we had a chance to work through many times before. So we know that, that we're going to have something very specific for this. If V were an affine parameter, then we would get 0. But V is not an affine parameter, so we don't get 0. So in fact, we get the generalized form of the geodesic equation with an acceleration term, a kappa-type term, on the right-hand side that, tells us that the parameterization is not affine. But here, because we can actually do this calculation, because we have a nice regular coordinate system to work with, we can actually calculate the left-hand side, show that it's equal to the right-hand side, and find out by calculation what the value of kappa is. So that was guaranteed because we know that the normal vector to a null hypersurface, is automatically going to satisfy the geodesic equation. What is not automatic is to find the value of kappa that is relevant for the Kerr horizon, for that specific null hypersurface. And that's something that requires a calculation. And it's really crucial for this calculation that we work in a good coordinate system because we're equating the components of a vector to the components of another vector. If we were to work in a singular coordinate system, we would not control the components of vectors very well in that coordinate system because we'd be working at the singularity of the coordinate system. So we could easily be led astray if we tried to do this coordinate using this calculation using bad coordinates. But fortunately, we have good coordinates to work with. We're working in VR theta psi coordinate. And the coordinates being regular means that there is no obstacle to doing this calculation. And you've done things like this before. I'm going to skip the details. And I'm just going to say that, as it turns out, for the curve spacetime, kappa is equal to r plus minus m divided by r plus squared plus a squared. And that's the quantity that people like to call the surface gravity. So we've seen this equation before in the context of null cones, things that were not necessarily event horizons. If we specialize this equation to the Kerr horizon, we get that kappa is a nice constant. And there, you know, maybe it's not remarkable given that the specification of the event horizon is theta independent, going back to the discussion we had previously. Nevertheless, we see that that kappa parameter here is also independent of theta. So maybe mathematically it's not so surprising, but there's still something pretty remarkable about this. And unlike the previous case where R plus was not, you know, was found to be theta independent, I said that this is just an artifact of the coordinates. There's something a lot more geometrical here about this because kappa is a scalar quantity. And it turns out that, you know, there's much more, you know, deeper ramifications about this, the fact that kappa is actually a constant across the event horizon. So the surface gravity, so-called, is constant across the horizon because it doesn't depend on theta. We're going to see that the induced metric on the null hypersurface is not spherical. It does depend on theta. So the geometry is not spherically symmetric because, you know, of the rotation producing a bulge of the horizon. But nevertheless, there are some quantities that turn out to be, you know, independent of theta, and kappa is one of them. Now, the name surface gravity is a little bit strange. And there's some, you know, things that you can do to justify the name. And if you read Wald, for example, there's some argument given about, you know, the origin of the name surface gravity. And it's really awkward. You have to consider, you know, a stationary observer just above the horizon. You calculate the acceleration vector for that observer, and you find that in the limit, it actually goes to infinity, not surprisingly. So now you take care of this infinity by renormalizing the acceleration vector, and you show that what survives is something that depends on kappa. And, you know, after you're done reinterpreting all of this and removing redshift factors and various things like that, you end up with the notion that kappa is related to that limiting value of the acceleration of the observer on the horizon, and you call the quantity surface gravity. I never found this discussion to be terribly compelling. I think ultimately the reason why people call this surface gravity is that if you actually calculate this for Schwarzschild, the surface gravity in the limit, R plus goes to 2m. So you get 2m minus m, that's m, divided by 2m squared. So that's m divided by the radius of the black hole squared. And if we were working on Earth, that's exactly what we would call surface gravity, right? That would be the G field on the surface of the Earth. So the point is that, well, there's something formally analogous that you can apply to a black hole. It does look like the G field at the surface of the black hole, even though operationally it doesn't make any sense. So people adopted the terminology and they called it surface gravity, even though for a black hole, you know, it's really defined in this way in, you know, much more geometrical terms. And if you try to assign any sort of local observer significance to this, you have to fight infinities and it becomes less compelling, at least according to my point of view. But anyway, the term surface gravity has certainly taken hold. I don't begrudge it. I think it's a fine name for it, but we just have to be aware that, you know, the words should be used with inverted commas because the interpretation is not, you know, that straightforward. All right. But anyway, it's a very important quantity that characterizes a black hole, black hole event horizon, and it's something that, you know, we'll talk about for quite a bit in, well, the limited time that we have in this course, because it's all going to be over at the end of next week. Okay, so that's the statement that, okay, we have a null hypersurface that falls in line with everything that we've talked about when we were talking about null hypersurfaces. The only distinction between, you know, the general formalism that we introduced and this particular one is that here we're dealing with specifically an event horizon. We have the null vector, the null normal that satisfies the geodesic equation. And in the normalization that we picked for the null vector that's tied to the time, you know, to the Killing vectors of the spacetime, we have this statement of the geodesic equation with a kappa that turns out to be independent of position on the event horizon. So that kappa is the same for each generator. every one of them has the same value of kappa, and that didn't have to be. In the general formalism, and there was no requirement that kappa had to be constant from generator to generator. It could vary, and here we just find that it doesn't. It's the same for all of them. Okay, but now I want to go back to this idea that I talked about before. I want to relate the two languages. I want to describe the event horizon in the same language that we use to describe any other null hypersurface. And the key step in that translation is to come up with coordinates on the null hypersurface that are going to be constant on the generators. And we don't have that because of the angular velocity of the black hole, so we're going to have to fix that. So let's talk about intrinsic coordinates. So those were the coordinates. I used to call them lambda and theta A. But now I've switched lambda to V. And we have to identify those two angles. So V is going to be the parameter that runs around, that runs along each generator. So that is settled, so that we're going to be using. And we need two angles that are going to describe, that are going to label the generators. And one of them, well, is pretty clear. So because the generators move with constant value of theta, we can use theta as a parameter. So we have that k theta being equal to d theta dv is 0. And that means that theta is constant on the generator. And that means that we can use that as one of our coordinates. So we're going to do that. Now the question is, what are we going to do for the second angle if we cannot use the new angle psi? So here we have that omega h is equal to k psi, and that's equal to d psi dv. And that means that, while psi is certainly not constant along the null generators, so we know all about this, but we can actually integrate this because theta, omega h is a constant. It tells us that psi is going to be omega h times v, so it increases linearly with the parameter v plus a constant of integration. And we can use that constant of integration as a generator label, because that constant will be different for each generator. So that constant is basically describing the value of the angle at v equals 0. And depending on which generator I pick, I'm going to have a different constant for each generator. So we're going to use this constant as a way of distinguishing generators. And that's going to be our co-moving constant coordinate on our second co-moving coordinate on the generator. So what I'm going to say here is that I'm going to call that constant chi, and chi is going to be constant on each null generator. So what's going to be our co-moving coordinates? So the generator labels theta 2 is going to be theta, the same theta coordinate that we started with, to begin with. And then I'm going to use theta 3, the second coordinate, to be chi, and both are going to be constant on generators. And, excuse me, now I have my three coordinates. And I have a very nice description of the null generators. I'll just write down the embedding relations. The embedding relations, remember, that's the relationship between the space-time coordinates x alpha and the intrinsic coordinates on the event horizon. And all I have to do is to list them all separately. So v, well, that's going to be the same as v. That's the zeroth coordinate. First coordinate, r, well, r is going to be a constant, r plus. R is not moving on the generators, so it's a sort of inert coordinate. theta is going to be theta. And then finally, psi is going to be omega h v plus that constant. And now I have, you know, a very nice set of embedding relations in terms of intrinsic coordinates on the horizon that I tied to generators, such that my two angles, theta and chi, are constant on each generator. And with that assignment, I can use all of the technology that we developed for null hypersurfaces and apply it without having to change one thing for a description of the Kerr horizon. You had a question?
Yeah, two questions. So first, I see that k phi is omega h, but k psi, or if I like go to this coordinate, do the coordinate transformation, I would get omega h.
I remember. So the t vector and the phi vector in that coordinate system have exactly the same angular components, the same components.
Right, and then the second question, so how do I know that the b is the parameter that gives me this kappa? Because remember that the kappa is the, it's dependent on the parameterization, right?
Right, so here the statement is that I pick v as my parameter because I really wanted to start from, you know, I started from this vector, so that gave me a parameterization in terms of v. And then with that choice of parameterization, that's the kappa that I get. You're certainly right to say that if I picked a different parameterization, I would get a different kappa. But that one is sort of the v parameterization is sort of preferred because v is aligned with the time-like killing vector. So it's a sort of natural time coordinate to use on the event horizon. Okay, other questions about what we just did? Okay, looks all good. So let me just write down a couple of more things and then we'll break for lunch. So those are the intrinsic coordinates, v, theta, and chi. V runs along the generators, that's the parameter along the generators. Theta and chi are constant. And if we want to identify the tangent vectors to the hypersurface, all we have to do is to take derivatives of the embedding relations. So let's work through this. And that's, you know, that's pretty simple. And then we're going to have our basis of vectors that we can use on the event horizon and do all the good stuff that we've done in the past. Okay, so the tangent vectors to the event horizon. Well, the general definition is that we have for each intrinsic coordinate, let me call it. We have the basis vector given to us by the partial derivative with respect to each one of. I didn't put that right. So that's how we came up with tangent vectors when we were talking about hypersurfaces in general and null hypersurfaces in particular. So we're going to have one tangent vector that's going to be attached to the intrinsic coordinate v. And by definition, that's the partial derivative of all the spacetime coordinates with respect to v. So we look at the embedding relations and we see that v is equal to v. So the partial derivative of v with respect to v is going to be 1. We see that r is independent of v. Theta is independent of v, so we get zeros over here. But we see that psi in the embedding relation is actually proportional to v. So its partial derivative for the phi component of that vector, for the psi component of that vector, is going to be omega h. And sure enough, what we've done here is to just reproduce the k vector. And that was always, you know, sort of guaranteed that the, you know, the first component, the first member of the basis vectors is always aligned with the generator normal. So we get that explicitly here. After that, we get a vector in the direction of theta, which is given to us by all the partial derivatives with respect to theta. And here we see that, well, the only thing that depends on theta is theta. So we get 0, 0, 1, 0. And then for the chi component, we figure out all the derivatives with respect to chi, and the only thing that depends on chi is psi. So we get 0, 0, 0, 1. So those are all the tangent vectors to the null hypersurface. We can complete the basis with an n vector. I'm not sure, I don't think I'm going to need it here, but that's something I'll reintroduce later on. And then we have a complete basis of vectors on the event horizon, and we can do all the usual things with it. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop here, and then I'm going to pursue this after lunch. We're going to calculate various things of interest, for example, the induced metric on the event horizon. That's going to give us the metric information that we can get about the event horizon. From that, we can calculate things like the surface area of the black hole, and we can come up with all sorts of nice relationships between area, mass, and angular momentum, and start talking about things like the first law, and so on and so forth. So let's leave that for the afternoon lecture. Any questions before we stop? Okay. So basically, the strategy here, which I'm just partly through, is to put the Kerr horizon into the framework of null hypersurfaces in general. We developed all this technology to deal with null hypersurfaces a few lectures back. Now we're taking advantage of all of this, and that's going to, the claim is that this is going to be a great help to describe the Kerr horizons, but also horizons of more general black holes as we continue the discussion. So it's all coming together now, hopefully in a very nice way. So, okay, so we'll pick this up again this afternoon.